Hello and welcome to Rogue Cell Radio, a community radio show hosted by two combat veterans who are passionate about helping veterans and fostering community. I'm your host, Sean Davis.
I'm Brad Peitzik. I'm the producer of the show. Let's get to our guest today. We have Nick. His call sign is Stitch.
Where did you grow up? Where were you born? Where you grew up?
So I was born in Hawaii, and I'm Hawaiian by birth, by blood. And so we moved away from there after probably about 3-4 years, and then went to the Northwest Washington State. And that's where I spent the rest of my childhood. And
how old were you when you moved to Washington?
Probably about 4, 3, 4.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then Northwest the rest of the time.
Have you ever lived in Hawaii since then?
No, I would go back every year for about like probably 3 months out of the year. So all the different school breaks, I'd go back to Hawaii and I'd be with my grandpa. So yeah, as a kid in, Washington, lots of good forests. So, made a couple good friends, and we were all about the soldier thing. We had airsoft guns and all that, and we do little mock battles all the time.
Right.
Loved building forts out in the forest, drilling rock climbing pegs into a giant like 200 foot tall sequoia so I could rock climb up it, but it was continuous because you could rock climb the entire way around the whole diameter of the thing, circumference.
Oh, wow.
And so yeah, and it went up like 20 feet. It's good fun.
This is probably a good time to segue and say that, Nick, you were an SF guy.
Yeah, so I was a TACP, and in the Air Force world, they call us Special Operations, or Special Tactics. And so I was a TACP, as Army probably know it, JTAC. And so I did that. I wanted to join because I thought I was a little too soft. I climbed Mount Rainier a couple of times. And I was like about 15, and I remember coming back down off the mountaintop and was crying and falling down because I had high altitude, probably cerebral edema, because I was falling every other step.
Oh my God.
So that's ataxia. It's like,
Yeah. So you thought you were too soft because you did that and you had problems?
Because I was 15 and coming down the mountain, 15 or 16. And I remember crying and stuff. And my buddy's like, what's going on? Cause I felt a tug on my rope. Cause we're on a rope team.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't freaking see because of all the stupid tears frozen on my glasses.
Wow.
But the stuff like that, I was like, I did a lot of rock climbing and martial arts and stuff like that. But I felt like I could be pushed further. I felt I could do more.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I want to go and serve my country. One day walking by the Air Force office, the guy was like, hey, come on in here real quick. And he talked me into doing signing up for combat control. So originally I was going CCT. That's another special operations in the Air Force, and their specialty. They're the only entity that can be like a combat guy and operate on their own. As a TACP, I'm just one guy, and then you're with your Army counterparts. Whereas this is a 6-man like combat control team. They can totally set up an airstrip and then provide air traffic control, land all the airplanes, and then of course they can do the shoot 'em up job and also call in airstrikes.
Oh, wow. And so you were in the military for how long?
I was in the military for 18 and a half years.
18 and a half
wow.
years. And you joined in 2006. That blows me away because I got out of the military in 2007.
Oh, wow.
That was such a long time.
So you were in the pickle suit days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Where we actually had to shine our boots and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I had to do that. Yeah, I remember that. Boots. I'd get so mad when someone would scuff my boots.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's, sit there breathing on it and doing the little buffing.
One of my sons was looking at his Doc Martens, and he's like, oh, these are starting to really look worn. I was like, I can help you with that. Like, you know how to shine boots? It's like, boy, do I.
Yeah.
So you are just recently separated then?
Yes. That was probably about 3 months ago.
3 months.
Why did you get out at 18 years?
My PTSD was getting really bad, and I was losing function. Going from being, completely squared away to where I was sitting in front of my medical gear that I had. I was also, sorry, I forgot to add that I transitioned halfway through my career to be a IDMT, That's a independent duty medical technician. And so that's like an 18 Delta without the combat stuff and not as well trained on the prolonged field care as a 18 Delta special forces medic. And so that means I was a medical provider at like kind of like being a physician assistant with a heck of a lot less going and then being a pharmacist and then doing what is that called? Dental. So dental emergencies. I did remove a tooth in Saudi Arabia from a guy. I had the whole kit with me. So I did that in the middle of the desert.
Wow. Oh, no.
Yeah. And then public health, especially COVID. I was on the front lines of developing our, what was it called? Viral Disease Center, VDC, that we had to see COVID patients separately. I was able to, like, you know, make up a whole patient, you know, check-in sheet and everything and all that. So we were right on the front lines dealing with that. And
where was that at?
That was at Seymour Johnson in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And so I was attached to the F-15Es. That's the Strike Eagles. Call them the Mud Hen. They're the ones that can do air-to-air and air-to-ground. And so that was my unit that I was stationed with.
Seems like you had a really great career going. Can you talk about the struggles that you had?
Probably since coming back from when I was attacked, when I came back from Iraq, 2008, I was really depressed and really struggling coming back from that deployment because I saw a lot of bad stuff happen, a lot of bad guys over there. And then because of politics and kind of what's, you know, allowed, you know, they want to have real low civilian injuries. And so a lot of the times, you know, it was just, you're not allowed to drop. So calling in an airstrike, you're just not allowed because there's too many civilians at risk.
Right.
And so that kind of guilt really weighed heavy on me. And, yeah, I tried to eat the gun. Shortly after coming back, tilted my head out of the way at the last second and fired up through the ceiling.
Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah.
And so and that was in 2008?
Yes.
And so you kept going in the military for years.
All my brothers that had fallen, I wanted to continue to serve.
So you had an incident where you almost killed yourself, and then you did you ask for help?
No. I remember being told even when I came back from Iraq, you know, they're like, dude, don't say yes that you saw dead bodies or that you killed anybody or anything like that, because you're gonna, mental health will put you through the ringer, they'll, you know, desert you for a short time and all this different stuff. They're like, it's just basically too much hassle.
So you were worried about your career?
Yeah.
Was that somebody in your command that said that to you?
No, fellow TACPs at my peer level.
So wow, I kind of understand a little bit. I mean, it's not yeah, totally, but like in the infantry, and I think you do too, as an officer. In the infantry, you're like, you just be tough, man. So what? You saw a dead body. So what? You had to shoot people. Just keep going. That's your job. And then, but we did have a lot of people when we came back because we had good leadership, at least in the National Guard, where it was like, you know what? Our baseline is that everybody, we all went through a lot of stuff over there. And our baseline is just, we're going to talk to somebody. And then if you need more help, we'll help you. But it doesn't sound like that happened for you.
Yeah.
No. And so how'd you live with this for such a long time?
I just dug down deep and I was like, I'm used to, from the training that we go through, we're trained that the more we struggle or the harder it is, the stronger we get. And so I kind of, you know, used that to generate the efforts needed to keep going. And I also wanted to share all of my strengths that I gained in special operations and through the experience of, you know, men, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, amazing, you know, mentors. And I wanted to pass those things on to people without them having to go through terrible trauma.
So you just lived with it, and your response to the pain and suffering that you felt was like, just be stronger.
I care about people. Mm-hmm. And even when I couldn't, after I broke my legs in 2009, and
you broke both your legs?
Both of my femurs. Oh my. Yeah, I shattered them.
You broke. Oh my god!
So my left,
so painful.
Left on an airborne operation.
Or? No, that one wasn't. I had another incident in a tree where I had to be rescued.
Oh, we're gonna talk about that.
Yeah. My left knee up under my chin and my right calf laying on my face, and I'm just like in denial, like sitting there. Your legs aren't broken. Your legs aren't broken. And I remember how heavy it felt. I was about probably 245 at the time, and I had massive, massive quads and hamstrings. So it was, when I broke them, it was able to keep the bone shards in, and I just bled into the legs. So that helped save my life. And then just screaming my head off,
yeah,
you guys, I'm not mad at you. I just can't stop screaming. And so one of my buddies, Tack Peabody's out there with me, was it was an ATV that crushed me. Mm-hmm. And so he was a prior paramedic, and so he was able to reset my legs for me and keep me kind of stable until the paramedics got there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got to the hospital. They told me I had a 5% chance of making it. My response to the doc, he was like, you know, you want a chaplain or anything, you know, anything we could do before we go into surgery? I was like, yeah, doc, I got these ingrown toenails. think you could work on those while you're in there?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, just no sense of humor. He's like, let's just focus on this right now. I was like, all right, buddy.
No bedside manner for him.
I made it back through the med boards, three med boards, and I was able to get my legs rebroken, and then they put me back into TACP. Problem was, is they didn't fix my leg properly. It was still super crooked. And so coming up to the 2012 deployment I was supposed to go on to Afghanistan, I got pulled off of it. And one of my greatest mentors, Major Gray, was on that deployment that I was supposed to be on, and he got killed. And so, you know, amazing. One of those, you know, the leaders that they don't need to scream, shout, or be like, you know, steely-eyed and terrifying in order to earn your respect. That's, you just wanted Major Gray. You wanted his respect. You wanted to do anything you could that he asked. So lost him. That sucked. That weighed on my conscience.
I bet. Yeah,
definitely. Man. And then I reclassed into, what's it called? Medical. And so, because I was like, you know what? I remember feeling the safest when there was a medic around. I was so in awe of, you know, how they could save lives, keep people alive, you know, and that's something, if my family ever got into danger when I'm out of the military, I can't shoot at problems.
Yeah.
But the medical guys, you know, they're trained in trauma and mental health, all this different stuff.
Like, and we were saying before, the mass casualty evacuations.
Yeah. Do it work in those. And then, yeah.
And these are skills that you can use now.
Yeah. And the public health stuff was huge. Like responding to a E. coli outbreak in Colorado Springs when I was stationed out there. Yeah. It's over 70 cases of poisoning. And it was a guy going around spraying rancid chicken water on the buffets.
This is all interesting, but I want to talk about the time that you got stuck in a tree.
Yeah, so we were at Fort Pickett.
I actually saw this video the other day.
Yeah, there's
where's
a video.
Fort Pickett? I don't...
Virginia.
Okay. If our listeners want to look it up, what would they look up on YouTube?
They'd look up New Fort Pickett Rescue and FT for Fort.
P-I-C-K-E-T-T. So how did you get in the tree?
So that was jumping out of a perfectly good helicopter. We were there with some soft TAC peas. And so they were out there. They wanted to get their jump in, so they'd have their rule four instated, which makes it so you get your jump pay the whole deployment.
Okay. Yep.
And my buddy, Jared Taylor, he was on the ground filming, and he like looks at the little wind speed reader, and it's saying like 22, 25 knots, and he's filming right over his shoulder. And then he steps behind a Humvee, and he's like, winds, five.
So I'm an airborne guy in the Army, and I can tell you that is...
MC-1-1 can handle 12 or 13 knots of wind.
Yeah.
So we're double wind capacity. Double.
Yeah, that's...
And you just go, oh, yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah, and then...
It's criminal that they said, go ahead and jump.
Well, and then they screwed the drop, too. And so the guy who's... the air crew guy is standing there making the calls, go, go, go. And so... We get out of there. I slipped on the ramp because there's those things leak hydraulic fluid. If it's not leaking hydraulic fluid, it means it's going to fall out of the sky. And so I slipped on some of that and fell. And fortunately, I fell forward and, you know, opening shock. And I immediately felt it. The winds were just so powerful.
Uh-huh.
And so I was over a lake. I was terrified. And so I'm trying to just go down as best I can. And then I see I'm getting heavily blown towards the trees. And so I start trying to do, you know, running with the wind and sweeping back around, running into the wind, trying to just dump as much air as possible. I ended up the first tree into the forest.
You
and
almost
so,
made it.
Almost made it.
If you're just joining us, this is Rogue Cell Radio. I'm Sean Davis, and I'm here with Nick, codename Stitch.
And so I saw first tree come in, and then second tree hits my toes, and the next one hits my knees. And so covered my groin to make sure I didn't get stabbed there. And yeah, I got stabbed right in my hand by a branch, protecting my groin. So I'm glad I did that.
Femoral.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't bleed to death.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the final one where it's coming down, I had my hand on my reserve ready to pop it. And as it came down, I heard my parachute ripping. Pop that reserve.
That's the reserve parachute.
Yes. Uh-huh. Pop that reserve. And so it gave me a little extra loft so I didn't snap all the branches. And then I was stable there in the tree just dangling. And I looked over. I saw another guy stuck in a tree about 80 feet up. And he's hugging a branch looking at me. And then his branch broke and he fell.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
He fell 80 feet.
Yeah, 80 to 90 feet. And then he just wasn't moving. Later on, you know, come to find out he had broken a couple of his vertebrae and fractured his skull. Yeah. But he survived it. So I was left there as the only one. My commander ended up 300 meters into the woods and landing at a creek. You know, it was just chaos.
Yeah.
From like a state away, there was some PJs, pararescuemen.
Yep.
And so they flew a helicopter down to come and get me. I was up there for about 3.5-4 hours. I was in Summerway BDUs, and it was like 35 degrees with high winds, so I was freezing. And my parachute had landed, so my harness was crooked so that the left side was higher than the right. So all my weight was on the left leg, so after about 5 minutes, I couldn't feel my leg. And I got to experience what it's like to have a tourniquet for 4 hours.
Oh, man. Jeez.
So they flew in, and yeah, the guy got
He didn't lose it. So how'd they get you out of the tree?
So yeah, the
wait, how far up were you?
About 100 some feet up.
Wow.
Oh, that was another thing I almost that almost got me killed was the reserve. So at a certain point, after about maybe 5 minutes, as things are starting to settle down, my chute started to reinflate and started yanking me, and I heard branches cracking above me. And so you can't jump with a knife in your pocket, mm-hmm. but what you can do, I had a little neck knife that was about like, you know, the blade was about an inch long or something like that, real skinny little buck knife. And so I just pulled that thing out. I was like, just, I was able to cut enough of the, you know, there's like 56 strings or something. I can't remember.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, but I was able to cut through at least half of them and it deflated. And I got to rest easy for a little bit. And then, yeah, it took about 3.5 hours for the pararescue guys to come fly overhead with their UH-60. And then they lowered this guy down through the trees and he's getting bashed around all over the place, going up and down, up and down. And, you know, he gets up to me and the first thing he does is he just whips out his big old combat knife. He's like, "You want me to cut you loose, man?" I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." And so he gets over his excitement, you know, and I can see it. You know, I completely understand. This is like what they live for. So I could tell he's having like the time of his life. And so we're having fun. He gets the little force penetrator that's got a little seat that comes down off of it and puts that under me and then straps me to him. And then we just did like in True Lies at the end where Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis. Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis are just flying outside the helicopter. That's what we did. And so they didn't bring me up. They just flew me over and then dropped me down.
He just rescued you right through that sunroof.
Yep.
That's funny. So I wanted to talk about kind of maybe switch gears here, but like you said you were having it problems a couple of years in, and then you just dealt
continued.
With it because you wanted to help other people and you're just like, I could just be strong. But and you got to about a year and a half before you're going to retire, or maybe 2 years before you retire. What happened that made it so you couldn't just keep doing what you were doing?
I was having things like I was documenting on a patient and I'd just freeze up for like 10 minutes at a time and like not even doing it, didn't realize the time had passed. My buddy, a fellow IDMT, he's like, "Dude, you okay?" I'm like, "Why?" Yeah, I'm kind of spacing out. He's like, "Yeah, you sat there, you typed and then you sat there for like 10 minutes and didn't move and then just deleted everything that you wrote and then started typing again and froze up."
Oh,
And so
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, because what I was doing was because being a medical person is nowhere near as exciting as being a TACP. So what I had to do was I treated it like it was life or death kind of thing. You know, you can activate that extra oomph. You know, you're pushing. I don't know. You know how when you push your limits each time, you feel that like pounding in your heartbeat in your throat. You get your hearing goes away. You get spots in your vision, and you're hyperventilating. You know, you feel like you're going to pass out kind of a thing. But if you keep pushing, then boom, you break through. And then you realize you're stronger than you were before you even started running. And so that strength right there that I had is what I used constantly to make myself pay attention. So I was constantly putting myself into that fight state of mind. And that kind of kill instinct is what I use to make myself pay attention on all the boring stuff, like documenting on a patient. I love doing the exams, love doing the differential diagnosis, but the going through and checking every single box that you have to check in the document, every single little thing you have to document on, that part I struggled with. And so that's the kind of stuff I would do.
So we were talking about your career as a special forces. You said, what does TACP stand for? I'm
sorry. Tactical Air Control Party.
Okay. And then you left that, still special forces, but you became a medic?
Yes. A medical person. Yes.
And now a medical person, which is more than a medic. I'm sorry. I didn't mean under.
A medical provider. Yeah.
Yeah. Which you were doing, you're like a physician's assistant, right, PA?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In austere environments.
Yes, all over the place in the world.
South America, too. I got to do that. It was good fun.
Wow. And then, so you did 18 years, and then at the end, you were close to retirement, but you're like, I just can't do this anymore.
I couldn't do it. I was so burnt out from using that fight or flight state of mind to force my body to function. And
it takes a toll, huh?
It takes a big toll. And especially since I cared so much about patients, I wanted to do preventative medicine.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to where you're talking about the fight or flight. And when you and I were texting about this interview a little bit, you said we are trained to be killers. So it sets the bar much higher for acceptable violent response, but there's no trained switch for turning it off.
Yeah, that's right. That's like in your book. You referred to we're sharks, you know, infantrymen. You're sharks. You're nature's perfect predator. You're trained for one thing and one thing only, and that's to destroy.
You know, I had a really hard time with my identity, you know, and that was the biggest reasons why I struggled so much with PTSD. Is like,
well, and that other part of being a warrior, you know, is being able to lay your sword and shield down and be a mentor, be a father. And these ways of, you know, it takes a lot of strength to be a parent. You know, I know I've struggled a lot with it. Yeah, that's a big piece of being a warrior, is training the next generation and having, you know, that nurturing kind of heart. And that's not something trained into you at all.
No.
With what we did.
We only have a couple minutes before we're running out of time. And for the last 18 years, you've been doing very similar things, a few different roles as you've been in your career. But what's next for Stitch?
What's next is I'm learning what I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah. How's that going?
It's rough. It's rough. Because you're a ship without a rudder.
Yeah.
And just kind of acknowledging that and going through it is a challenge in itself, but it's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like hitting your hand with a hammer, you know, it feels so good once you stop and you appreciate your hand before it was smashed. And so just realizing that this is just a natural progression in my life definitely makes it easier to go through.
Yeah. So now you're out, and before, I know we're close to the time, but I wanted to talk about now that you're out, I believe, and I think, you know, Brad and I did this whole road trip around the state of Oregon, talking to veterans, especially veterans with PTSD and having trouble transitioning. We came to like this, hypothesis, where helping in your community can help you transition from, you know, or help you through your PTSD. And I think an amazing way for people to do that is to join the CERT teams. And those are the community emergency response teams in your neighborhood. All right, you're thinking about doing that?
Yes, absolutely. My mom is actually on the CERT team. Oh. But yeah, with all the medical training I have and the experience of like having to stand up like a little clinic for yourself in a place where there's nothing that exists. And, you know, it being, you know, it's austere environments, which mimics something like if we were to have a tsunami here and go through and know all the stuff that, you know, you need to have on you and the stuff you need to support until, you know, you get higher levels of care available. And yeah, even things like a walking blood bank is so simple to do.
And it just makes sense because, I mean, what else would you do with all of the skills that you've learned over your 18 years in the military? I mean, it'd just be a waste not to use them, right?
Nick, do you have anything that you would say to anybody? Normally I ask about saying something to a veteran, but you're kind of new to that. How about somebody that's in the twilight of their military career?
Yeah, I'd say that have compassion on yourself. I was struggling and I didn't know why, because I was doing the absolute best I could and still just being destroyed and not able to function and doing activities of daily life. And it turned out I was undiagnosed with bipolar type 1, and I didn't know that. So, you know, there may be things that are just beyond your understanding right now, and you just gotta go through it head up and facing, you know, into the fire.
I want to ask another last question, but to somebody who is afraid to ask for help because they think their career will be ruined, or they just think it's not something that strong men or strong people do, I mean, what advice would you give to them?
Family comes first. And so you having problems and not getting help for them, you know, the whole reason you're fighting, yeah, you want to fight for your country, but more importantly, you fight for your brother to the left and the right, and higher than that, you fight for your family. And so you got to think, you know, we're on a different battlefield now. As you're approaching the end of your career, the battlefield is changing.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd say as a parting piece of advice my godfather gave me, he was the first of Special Forces back in like Vietnam, you know, he said, you know, the sword is greater than the shield, and tactics are greater than both, but the greatest weapon of all is your mind. And so taking all that stuff that we've learned throughout our careers, you know, we have quite the quiver of arrows to deal with problems. We just need to believe in ourselves.
Thank you for listening to Rogue Cell Radio.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Together with Veterans Northwest Oregon, or the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition, or the Department of Veterans Affairs. You can find us at roguecell.vet or facebook.com/groups/roguecell. If you or a loved one is experiencing thoughts of suicide, help is available. Please call 988 and press 1 for veterans. This line is answered 24/7, so there is always someone to help. And with help comes hope, and hope saves lives. The second of the 503rd Rogue Cell is produced by Brad Peitzig with support from Together with Veterans, and is hosted by Sean Davis. Thank you for joining us.